Let's talk a little bit about uncertainty and entrepreneurship within the Austrian tradition. Uncertainty tends to get a little bit of short shrift within neoclassical economics, partly because it's sort of confused with or typically modeled as probabilistic risk, which is not the same thing, as we'll see in just a moment, and also because it's typically treated as sort of a minor add-on, a sort of extension to the standard theories and models, which are usually done without any regard for uncertainty or risk. Entrepreneurship, as you already know from earlier lectures this week, does not get a very prominent place in conventional treatments at the microeconomic or macroeconomic level. So one of the things that distinguishes the Austrian school from other approaches to economic analysis is the central role that Austrians give to both uncertainty and entrepreneurship. Remember, if I can take you back to the lectures from the very beginning of the week, Austrian economists are interested in purposeful human action, to use Mises' terminology. And the study of human action implies, first of all, an attention to means and ends, right? We get that from Karl Menger and his causal realist approach to understanding economic phenomena. So purposeful human behavior involves the use of scarce means to achieve desired ends. The notion of using means to achieve ends also implies the passage of time. So the results of human action are not manifest instantly, immediately, but only after some action that takes place through time. And there's uncertainty about the results, right? We're not always satisfied that our actions led to the outcomes that we desired, that we anticipated. Sometimes we feel that our ex post, our action is successful. We may also deem it to be unsuccessful. We did not, in fact, achieve the end that we aspired to achieve through our action. So these kinds of basic notions are built in to the very idea of purposeful human behavior. Oops. Oh, sorry. When Mises talks about entrepreneurship, in the most general sense, he refers specifically to human action under conditions of uncertainty. Mises says the term entrepreneur, as used by economic theory, means acting man exclusively seen from the aspect of the uncertainty inherent in every action. So being an entrepreneur is acting in the face of the uncertainty that is incorporated into all human action in our world, in the world that we live in. Right? One implication of that is that all action contains a measure of entrepreneurship. We are all entrepreneurs when we act in the world. Now, as we'll see in just a moment, it may often be useful to distinguish between this most broad notion of entrepreneurship and a narrower, more specific concept of what you might call commercial entrepreneurship or catalactic entrepreneurship, referring specifically to business professionals who act under uncertainty for the specific aim of maximizing their money, their money profit and avoiding loss and so forth. But as at the most general level, entrepreneurship is embedded in all human behavior. Oh, whoops, sorry, I skipped. What do we mean by uncertainty? What does Mises mean when he says entrepreneurship is about human action under conditions of uncertainty? Well, let me first distinguish between uncertainty and risk. And I'll start by using the terminology that we get from Frank Knight, a famous American economist who wrote in the early 20th century. Frank Knight is not considered a member of the Austrian school, though I've argued in another context that many of Knight's views are, in fact, congenial with the views of the Austrian school, Mises in particular. Particularly Knight's view on entrepreneurship, uncertainty in the business firm. But Knight is famous for introducing in his 1921 book, or popularizing in his 1921 book, Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit, the distinction between risk and uncertainty. So what Knight means by risk, and I mentioned this briefly in a lecture earlier in the week, is a situation where the outcome of action is unknown, but we have a very good sense of sort of how to define the problem. In other words, it's like, you know, it's like rolling a die. Okay, if I have a six-sided die and it's a normal, you know, unweighted die, so not the kind that David Gordon or Walter Block would use, a normal die, when I roll the die, I don't know what number is going to come up, right? But I know there are six numbers, and the probability of any one number coming up is 1/6. So we can actually compute, you know, what's the expected value of rolling that die a certain number of times. If I get, you know, $5 if a 3 comes up, and I get $10 if a 6 comes up, I can use I can just use algebra to calculate what's the average payoff or the expected payoff of rolling that die once or many times or whatever. There are other situations, however, other situations where we don't know what's going to happen as the result of our action. We don't know what outcomes we'll obtain in the future, tomorrow, whatever. And we don't even know that we can't even write down the set of possible outcomes, much less attach some kind of probability weights to them. Okay, so I can't even describe the problem the same way that I can describe a gambling problem. Okay, so if you ask me, you know, what's the expected value of rolling the die if, you know, I win $100 if it comes up a 6 and otherwise I don't win anything? What's the expected value of rolling the die? Well, it's $1,000 times 1/6. Okay? What's the expected value of starting a business today? What's the likelihood that I will, you know, meet my future mate tomorrow? Well, I'm already married, but you, right? What's the probability that you will meet the perfect person tomorrow and, you know, fall in love and live together happily ever after? You can't express that in an equation the same way that you can express the, you know, how the expected value of winning or the likelihood that I'll win at my craps game, you know, as 1/6, or expected value is 1/6 times some number, right? The problem cannot be parameterized in that way. Now, Knight was talking specifically about the decisions of business people, right? Business people who are trying to earn money, trying to earn profits, trying to avoid losses. When they have to make a decision about what product to produce, what resources to obtain, what marketing strategy to use, and so forth, they cannot analyze that problem the same formal way that we would analyze a dice-throwing problem. Now, there's sort of another way to express the same distinction, and this is the expression that Mises uses. And Mises gets this distinction from some very important work by his younger brother. If you didn't know, Ludwig von Mises came from a very very brilliant family. His younger brother, Richard, is an internationally famous probability theorist. He was a professor in Germany before coming to the U.S. in the 1930s and settling at Harvard. So Richard von Mises was a Harvard professor, a very influential statistician. And Ludwig adopted his own approach to probability from Richard. And apparently, as an aside, the two brothers did not get along. And Ludwig does not actually cite Richard in Human Action when he's when he has this in the context of this discussion. Whether that was an intentional, you know, dig at little brother or not, I leave that up to the historians to decide. But the terminology that Richard introduced is the following. Richard distinguished between two different kinds of likelihood, two different situations where we don't know what's going to happen in the future. One is Richard calls case probability, and the other he calls class probability. Right, so class probability describes a situation where we have an event, and we don't know the outcome of that event, but that event can be meaningfully classified from the actor's point of view into a class of very similar events, a class of homogeneous events, a class of repeatable events. So in the case of throwing the die, right, I mean, my throwing the die right now is in many ways structurally similar to throwing the die yesterday or tomorrow. Each time I roll the dice, an individual roll is very much like all of the other rolls. Okay, so if we wanted to, if we didn't know anything about, if we didn't know how to theorize about probabilities and we didn't know the likelihood of any number coming up was 1 over 6, we could just observe. We could just throw the dice 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, and simply count how many times did it come up 1, how many times did it come up 2, and so forth. Right? So in Richard's theory, if you can imagine a class of repeatable events, the probability of any particular outcome is the limit of that frequency distribution. You know, if you kept on rolling and rolling and rolling, the number of times any one particular outcome would obtain in the limit will be equal to whatever that is in the limit. That's the probability of that particular event occurring. This applies not only to games of chance. If you think about insurance markets, for example, most people who own a home have insurance against fire, let's say. Okay, so nobody knows what is the probability that your house will catch on fire tomorrow. However, your house is very similar to other houses that are about the same size, that have roofs made out of the same materials, that are in the same neighborhood, in the same city, same type of area, and so forth. And so we know from looking at history, we know from looking at actuarial tables, what's the likelihood that a particular type of house will catch on fire on any particular day. And from that, we can estimate the likelihood that your house will catch on fire. Okay? I have to know a lot about you. I only need to know the characteristics of the class in which you are a member. Okay? Just like, being struck by lightning, right? I can't say how likely it is that I will be struck by lightning, but you can look it up, I don't know how many Americans are struck by lightning in a given year, right? So if I among people who are walking outside in a thunderstorm, I can use that historical data to estimate what's the likelihood that it will happen to me. Okay. Now again, if I'm walking around with one of those lightning poles, or I'm flying my kite in the rain like the Benjamin Franklin or whatever, well now that's a different class from just people walking down the street innocently. Okay, you're sort of courting the lightning in that case. So we have to use our knowledge of the situation, of your characteristics, to decide what class you meaningfully belong to. However, there is another kind of situation where we cannot bundle the events into classes of homogeneous actions, right? Where each case is unique, such that we really can't make any inference about what will happen in this case based on what happened in similar cases. Business profit is much like that. Okay, the likelihood that you'll fall in love tomorrow. We simply don't know enough details of the situation to put your walk, mingling with other people in a class of other people mingling to calculate the likelihood that, something will happen to you as opposed to somebody else. In cases like that, according to Richard and Ludwig, right, the decision maker cannot write down a mathematical formula and use that to tell what's the best thing to do. Right? We can't speak about the optimal behavior or the efficient behavior or the profit-maximizing behavior by solving an algebra problem because we simply cannot express that particular situation in terms of mathematics. Therefore, how the decision maker copes with class probability is by using a kind of intuition, or the Austrians use the German word Verstehen, roughly translated as understanding, a kind of deep situational understanding. In other words, the claim of Mises, both Mises brothers, and for that matter, the claim of Frank Knight, is not that decision makers, when faced with genuine uncertainty rather than risk, or when faced with class probability rather than case probability, are just blind. It's not that they just behave randomly, right? No, they behave in a purposeful way, but the way they conceive of the future, the way they try to anticipate what is likely to happen if they do this or if they do that, cannot be expressed as an equation. It's something more fundamental, more intuitive. It's gut instinct, it's feeling, it's intuition, it's understanding. Now, how does this relate to entrepreneurship? Well, Mises talks about different economic functions performed by agents in an economy, Right? So imagine something called the pure entrepreneur, an agent who does nothing but act under uncertainty. Okay? Now, in contrast to the economic functions performed by other agents in an economy, like you can imagine sort of the pure function of labor, right? The function of labor is to exchange labor services for something else, money, let's say. Okay, so you can imagine, even if there were no uncertainty in the world, even in, you know, the imaginary construct of Mises' evenly rotating economy, or some other kinds of situation we can imagine in our minds, where we know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow, there's no uncertainty, you can still have workers working for wages, okay? Likewise, you could have landowners who are renting out their property in exchange for rental income. You can have capitalists who forego present consumption in exchange for future consumption, who lend their money out and are repaid at a rate of interest determined by time preference. So even if there were no uncertainty, you could still have workers earning wages, landowners earning rents, capitalists earning interest income. But there wouldn't be any return to acting under uncertainty because there's no uncertainty. Okay? The pure entrepreneurial function in this context is to make decisions under uncertainty and to receive either profit or loss based on the success with which that entrepreneur anticipates uncertain future conditions. Okay? And you can think of the simplest example in a monetary context, you know, a glass of water, right? If I'm a water entrepreneur, right? Let's say I can acquire the resources necessary to produce this cup of water. It costs me so many cents for the plastic, so many cents for the water that goes in it, so much in labor and maybe advertising and marketing and so on. If I can purchase inputs for, say, you know, 62 cents to produce this glass of water, and I can sell it to somebody for 75 cents, right, then I have some income left over. I have some profit. Now you say, well, wait a minute. How am I able to get factors for 68 cents that can be used to produce something that sells for 75? Well, think about it. Imagine that I'm competing with other potential users of that plastic and that labor and that water. If there are many glass of water sellers competing against each other for the dollars of the consumers who wish to buy water, right? Then if all of the entrepreneurs anticipate that you can sell these things for 75 cents, then they will compete against each other to acquire these factors of production. Everybody wants to get something that you can sell for 75 cents and only have to pay 68 cents to make it. But of course, as entrepreneurs compete for the labor and the water and the plastic, what happens to the prices of those intermediate goods? They go up, right? They're bid up as entrepreneurs compete for the services of those intermediate goods, right? So if everybody knew that you could sell water for 75 cents, then in light of competition among entrepreneurs in a kind of long-run equilibrium state, the factors of production would be bid up so it costs exactly 75 cents worth of stuff to make something that you can sell for 75 cents, abstracting away from interest, time preference, discounting. Okay, but if in fact I can purchase the inputs for 68 cents, that indicates that not everyone who might purchase those inputs and use them to make water and sell it has the same beliefs that I do about how, like, you know, about what I can, about the selling prices, right? Some entrepreneurs might believe that you can only sell these for 50 cents. And so they wouldn't be willing to pay 68 cents worth of materials to get something they think that will only sell for 50 cents, right? So if I am actually able to earn a profit, a money profit, if I can, if my total revenues exceed my total costs, ignoring discounting for the moment, then that's because I did a better job than my competitors in anticipating what the future prices would be. Therefore, I've earned profit, right? If I made a mistake, if I overpaid for the factors of production, I'll end up with a loss. So profit and loss only accrue to decision makers who are bearing uncertainty, okay? Now, in the example that I just gave, the profit and loss is monetary. But if you like, you could think about entrepreneurs, human actors, who are not operating in a monetary catalactic context, in which they experience profit and loss as a purely mental, psychological, or psychic phenomenon. For example, all of you sitting in the room right now. Okay, why are you here? Well, because on the schedule it says we have to be here. Well, I mean, you know, you could be outside or something, right? Presumably the reason you're here is because you are anticipating that you will get something valuable out of this lecture, right? You'll get some knowledge, or maybe you're just here for the eye candy. But it does cost you something to be here, right? There's an opportunity cost of your time, if nothing else. And the fact that you're sitting here tells me that you anticipated that the value of being here would exceed the cost of, you know, giving up your time. I'm hopeful that, and I have every expectation that at the end of this lecture, you're all going to be just jumping up and down and cheering, and, you know, practicing for the concert tonight, maybe. But you'll all be walking out of the room thinking, oh, man, that was awesome. That was so great. That was so much better than anything else I could have done with this hour, like take a nap. Okay. But, you know, it's possible that maybe one or two of you will think, oh, my gosh, why didn't I go back to the dorm and take a nap? This was a total waste of time. That guy didn't teach me anything, whatever. Okay, so the former category, though, all of you earned a profit, right? If you got more out of this in a purely subjective sense than what you gave up to be here in a subjective sense, you earned a profit. Okay, now, I can't put a number on that. Right? But you know whether you earned a profit or a loss in this purely psychic sense. So you're acting as an entrepreneur just in showing up here, just not in a monetary sense. And again, you know, from the point of view of economic theory or economic policy or economic history, if we want to understand, you know, what's going on in the market economy and why are we in a recession and why are, you know, prices of computers falling or whatever, just looking at the psychic profits and losses of consumers who are deciding whether to go lectures or not, you know, it's probably not going to give us a lot of information. We might be more interested in those entrepreneurs who buy and sell capital goods and labor in organized markets and try to sell them to make money. Their decisions may have more of an impact on the real economy. So they may be more interesting or important as entrepreneurs, but that doesn't make you and me and all of us every day any less entrepreneurial in our acting. Okay? And of course, all entrepreneurs, even in the psychic sense, they do have some inputs. You know, I mean, tools, the opportunity, pencil, your iPad, whatever, your paper, you know, the opportunity cost of your time. Your body is a resource, right? You could be using your body to earn income, you know, as a laborer or something right now instead of sitting here as a consumer. So all of us act as entrepreneurs in this way. Probably the first sort of explicit formulation of this very general idea comes from the famous French economist Richard Cantillon, or Cantillon, if you prefer the French pronunciation. Cantillon's famous book, published in the middle of the 18th century on economic processes, gives a very central role to the entrepreneur. And Cantillon uses the following language. He says, entrepreneurs work for uncertain wages, so to speak, and all others for certain wages until they have them. The general who has a salary, the courtier who has a pension, and the domestic who has wages are in the latter class, meaning people who work for certain wages. All the others are entrepreneurs, whether they establish themselves with a capital to carry on their enterprise, or are entrepreneurs of their own work without any capital, and they may be considered as living subject to uncertainty. Even beggars and robbers are entrepreneurs of this class. Right, so for Cantillon, the key distinction between entrepreneurs and laborers, landowners, capitalists, is whether their income, their returns are certain or uncertain. Okay, so anybody who, you know, if you own your own business, then the amount of income you get day to day, week to week, year to year varies. It fluctuates with business conditions, right? If you're a beggar, how much, I guess this should be translated as differently housed person or something like that. You know, how much money, that's like homeless, you get it? How much money you have at the end of the day, you don't know. It depends on how many people walk by and how generous they are. If you're a salaried employee or a civil servant or whatever, then you're not an entrepreneur because your income, you get the same amount of money every week or every month or every year. Okay? Now, of course, You could say, well, but even a civil servant might be fired, and there's some uncertainty about that. And that's, of course, true. But the critical distinction Cantillon is making is between those returns that are uncertain and those returns that are certain. And entrepreneurs are simply those whose returns are uncertain. How do we link the entrepreneur function and the capitalist function? Keep in mind that in my previous slide, right, in the absence of uncertainty, the capitalist earns an interest return for lending out funds. But in the world of uncertainty, if you own productive resources, if you own capital goods, machines, factories, land, and so forth, improved land, and so forth. You get a return that's not only has an interest component, but also you get some profit or loss based on uncertainty, right? So the entrepreneur who hires labor and pays for that labor today in anticipation of receipts that will be earned in the future, right? If those total revenues cover the total, more than exceed the total costs, this entrepreneur will have some money left over. Part of that is an interest return resulting from the fact that the payments that were made to the workers were discounted according to the workers' time preference, right? But another component of that return will depend on the skill with which that entrepreneur anticipated future market conditions, okay? So when we talk about businesses, when we talk about firms, corporations, partnerships, proprietorships, we're really looking at the intersection of this pure capitalist function and this pure entrepreneur function. And it even makes sense to talk about capitalists and entrepreneurs going together, the capitalist and the entrepreneur. And there's some truly excellent literature that you can get at the bookstore downstairs to tell you all about how the capitalist and the entrepreneur are linked. In other words, the way I like to think of the business firm is it's the capitalist and the entrepreneur together. It's the capitalist entrepreneur who is the driving force of the market economy. What does these Austrian concepts we've been discussing, what insight do they give us about the theory of the firm, about the capitalist entrepreneur? Capital resources are heterogeneous, right? You know, assembling plastic and water and labor to make cups to sell is complicated, even in a simple case like that. There's lots of different kinds of machines and lots of different kind of plastic and different sources of water and different types of labor. Resources are heterogeneous. Production takes time. Entrepreneurs must engage in economic calculation. And you remember from Professor Salerno's lecture, this is something I touched on earlier this week, the economic calculation problem, while typically expressed in the context of a socialist economy, is not exclusively a theory about socialism, right? It's about the need for markets and prices for intermediate goods. But remember, what calculation is the process of comparing expected future returns against present expenditures expressed in a common unit, namely money prices, right? So what the socialist planner cannot do to evaluate the effectiveness of various courses of action is what the capitalist entrepreneur does every day. Okay, that's what the capitalist entrepreneur does every day is perform economic calculation. Okay, should I make these things and try to sell them? Where should I sell them? To whom should I try to sell them? How should I market them? What should I make them out of? What should I use, more labor-intensive production or capital-intensive production? What kind of plastic should I use, or should I use paper? Where do I source my water? Do I get it from some mountain spring in Switzerland, or do I scoop it out of the, you know, Auburn City lake or whatever? I mean, all these decisions, how do I do it? Should I do it at all? I make by comparing the prices of all of these resources expressed in money against my anticipated future receipts expressed in money. I'm performing economic calculation when I make this decision about being, all my decisions about being a water entrepreneur. Okay, that's what the socialist planner cannot do, because the socialist planner does not have money prices for all of these intermediate goods. So economic calculation is not exclusive to socialism. It's not an issue just of socialism. That's what business people do every day. Now, moreover, I talked about entrepreneurs trying to earn profit and avoid loss. How do we know that they do it? Right? What if they're lousy at it? Some people are good, some people are bad. I won't pick on Professor Engelhardt, who used the example in several of his lectures about his own investment prowess. How do we know that entrepreneurs will get it right? Well, Mises is very careful here. He does, by no means does he claim that entrepreneurs are universally successful in earning revenues in excess of their costs. By no means, right? The capitalist system is, you know, sometimes mistakenly described or incompletely described as a profit system. And indeed, it is a profit system, but it's only half of it, right? It's a profit and loss system. And capitalist entrepreneurs earn losses just as often as they earn profits. However, there is competition in the market for entrepreneurs. In other words, entrepreneurs who are systematically poor at making these, at anticipating future market conditions, will systematically lose money, right? And eventually they'll run out of resources. They'll run out of capital. They won't be able to buy any more factors of production. No one will lend them money to buy factors of production. And they really can't be entrepreneurs anymore. They have to go and do something else, okay? Whereas those who are consistently, systematically skilled at correctly anticipating future conditions and earning profits will find their capital expanding. They'll be able to increase their activities. And, you know, this is when we talk about the market process of steering productive resources toward those who can make the best use of these resources, we mean skilled entrepreneurs prosper and expand, unskilled entrepreneurs go bankrupt. Okay? Now, We've been talking about entrepreneurship as a general category, right? Sort of the praxeology of entrepreneurship. However, when we look at entrepreneurial behavior in practice, when we look at economic history, you know, recent events, or what Mises calls thymology, right? Study of sort of looking at real-world historical events using economic theory, we might want to go beyond simply these general theoretical categories and talk about particular entrepreneurs who are really good at what they do and do it in a certain way. And Mises says the following in Human Action. He says, economic theory, he means, also calls entrepreneurs those who are especially eager to profit from adjusting production to the expected changes in conditions. Those who have more initiative, more venturesomeness, and a quicker eye than the crowd, the pushing and promoting pioneers of economic improvement. In other words, as Mises notes, in the literature on economics, the word entrepreneur is typically used not only for this abstract theoretical category of agents bearing uncertainty, but also for guys like Steve Jobs, right, or Bill Gates, or Lou Rockwell, or others who are just particularly good at innovating and coming up with new things and being creative and exercising leadership and so forth. And Mises notes in this passage of Human Action, it's like a lament. He says, you know, it's sort of too bad that the same word is used for these different things, one for this abstract theoretical category, but also as sort of a descriptive label for a particular type of person. What, you know, in the terminology of Max Weber, we might call an ideal type. And Mises says, why don't we use a different word for these skilled, creative, decisive, innovative leaders? And Mises suggests the word promoter. I think Mises is right that it is useful to have two different words for these two different concepts. The term promoter has unfortunately not really caught on in the mainstream literature. But again, it's not just economic theory, right? If you think about how the word entrepreneur is typically used in everyday discourse, and I'm speaking here mainly to I'm addressing the native English speakers, because I know that in Spanish, to some degree in French, Italian, Portuguese, and so forth, the word entrepreneur has a slightly different connotation than it does in English. In English, to call somebody an entrepreneur is a compliment, right? An entrepreneur, that's sort of an honorific. We think of entrepreneurs as being guys and gals who are really clever, and they have a lot of initiative, and they exercise leadership, and typically their characteristics are manifest in creating a business. They start a new business, or they expand an existing business, or they're radical innovators, and so on. That's the way the word entrepreneur is used in the newspaper. And, you know, you can get Entrepreneur Magazine, over at Barnes & Noble, you know, the magazine section. It's not about agents bearing uncertainty in the praxeological sense, right? It's about people like Steve Jobs, okay? So what exactly does the promoter do according to Mises? The promoter owns and invests resources. This promoter is a capitalist, okay? This promoter is particularly alert to perceived opportunities in the environment. Make note of that sentence. The promoter is creative, exercises leadership, and so forth. But the point is, this promoter concept, this is not part of praxeology, strictly speaking, right? The promoter is a more loosely defined, kind of historically contingent concept than the pure functional entrepreneur of economic theory, right? So, you know, maybe I can't precisely define a promoter right now, but I know one when I see one. Okay, I can tell you who's a promoter or not. That's sort of like, you know, the classic definition of pornography. You can't really define it, but you know it when you see it. Okay, same thing with a concept like the promoter. Now, this leads me to say a little bit more about sort of Austrian versus mainstream views of entrepreneurship. And so there's been a huge surge of interest in entrepreneurship among mainstream scholars in economics, but also in management and in engineering and in a number of different disciplines and contexts. And one useful way to distinguish sort of the mainstream perspective on entrepreneurship with the Austrian perspective on entrepreneurship is in terms of, you know, what does this label apply to? What is the thing that entrepreneurship defines or describes? And so in most of the mainstream literature, entrepreneurship is thought of as a phenomenon that you can observe in the data, right? Such as self-employment or business starts, right? So in the mainstream management literature, entrepreneurship is typically just a synonym for self-employment, right? So if you own your own business, you are an entrepreneur. If you work for somebody else, you are not an entrepreneur, okay? Or if you start a new business, you're an entrepreneur. If you work at an existing business or you even manage a business that's already in, you know, it's already been going for a while, you're not an entrepreneur. I mean, and right away, you can see there's some sort of difficulties in knowing the boundaries here because, you know, Steve Jobs, along with his partner, Wozniak, founded Apple Computer. So according to this definition, they were clearly entrepreneurs at that point. But that, you know, now Apple is a, you know, multi-million dollar company, a billion dollar company. Apple is not a startup. So, you know, Steve Jobs before he died and the guy now, Tim, what's his name, who runs Apple. I mean, are they entrepreneurs? I mean, I guess they're still sort of self-employed, but they're not starting a new business. So presumably, according to this view, entrepreneurs eventually morph into something else, but you can't say exactly when they do it. Sometimes the word entrepreneurship is used loosely for just, you know, anything to do with small business. So at your university, there may be courses that you can take at your university in entrepreneurship. And typically these courses are, you know, sometimes they're very pragmatic, hands-on training seminars, how to start a business, how to run a small business, you know, basic accounting and marketing and so on, how to get venture capital, how to give an elevator pitch explaining your business idea to somebody who might give you money for it and so forth. Maybe it has something to do with innovation or new product introduction. Notice the contrast between this sort of idea of entrepreneurship as a thing that you can look out the window and see with the much more general abstract notion of entrepreneurship as a fundamental aspect of behavior. Right? You know, either the broad definition of action under uncertainty or a narrower definition of, you know, business entrepreneurs, people who are, acquiring and deploying heterogeneous resources in pursuit of money profit. If I were to ask you, get me some statistics on entrepreneurship. How much entrepreneurship is there in Auburn, Alabama relative to some other town? Is there more or less entrepreneurship in the U.S. today as opposed to the U.S. 50 years ago? Now, if you think that I mean what percent of the population is self-employed in Auburn relative to someplace else, or how many new firms were incorporated or registered in Auburn as opposed to someplace else. You could scurry off to the library and get that information, right? You can spend a few minutes on your computer. You could probably get that data and you could plot a graph for me or do whatever I want. Okay, if I say, how much uncertainty bearing is there in Auburn, Alabama compared to some other place? It's a lot harder to get a chart. Okay, it's a lot harder to do a graph to come up with a data series on that. We don't observe judgmental decision making under uncertainty. That's not something that we can easily quantify. So naturally, modern social science researchers who think, if you were listening in some of the other lectures on method this week, right, think that science is about collecting data and doing statistical analysis of it. If that's your belief, well then, you know, studying entrepreneurship as a broad sort of functional category is not very useful. You can't get data on it, right? You want to study something you can measure and count. So I think that's one of the reasons that mainstream scholars find this phenomenon-based approach to entrepreneurship relatively appealing, because you can get data on it, okay? Whereas it's much, you know, entrepreneurship in the abstract as a functional category is not quantitative, it's qualitative. Now, it turns out that even within the Austrian literature, there is some difference of opinion among different scholars about exactly how this function should be parameterized. Okay, let's say we agree that entrepreneurship is a fundamental aspect of human behavior. We agree that it's a function rather than a phenomenon. Well, what exactly is the function? How do you articulate this function? Give me a precise definition of this function. Well, I have been expounding the view that you find in Mises and earlier in Frank Knight and in Richard Cantillon and so forth. But within the Austrian school and related schools of thought, there are alternative. There are different ways to think about it. And for example, very prominent contemporary Austrian economist Israel Kirzner, recently retired from after a long career at New York University, pupil of Mises, also at NYU, has done some very influential work characterizing entrepreneurship in a slightly different way from the way I've been characterizing it. Right? So Kirzner describes entrepreneurship as alertness to opportunities for gain. Alertness to opportunities for gain. Or, he sometimes puts it, the discovery of valuable profit opportunities in the economy. Right? So Kirzner would formulate my water story in a slightly different way. Okay, so let's say that I am a successful water entrepreneur, and I'm actually making money. I'm selling these things for 75 cents, and I only have to pay, what did I say, 68 cents for the materials? So that's a difference of, Austrians are not good at math, right? 7 cents, okay. So Kirzner would say, you're earning a 7-cent profit on selling these water bottles. How were you able to do that? Well, you, Klein, right, you perceived that you could acquire something for 68 cents that you could then sell for 75 cents. So that $7 profit is something that I saw, but other people did not, right? Other people were, you know, every day walking by the little market where they sell plastic cups, and it never occurred to them that, oh my gosh, I could get these plastic cups and fill them for water and transport them somewhere and sell them for more than it cost me, right? There are opportunities to earn income, but not everybody is aware of these. Not everybody can perceive them. So the simplest kind of profit to think of in that example is one where there isn't even any production, but just think about arbitrage. Think about, you know, currency market arbitrage, these day traders and other people who sit in their, you know, in their home office, and they're looking at, you know, commodity prices or futures or you know, currency exchange rates and say, oh my gosh, if I go over here, I can swap euro for dollars at this rate, and then I take them over here and I swap dollars for euro at a different rate, I can actually earn a little bit of profit there, right? Professor Engelhardt knows that the fundamental, you know, principle of investing, buy low and sell high. So if somebody is offering the materials over here for 68 cents and you can sell the final product for 75 cents, I can buy low and sell high and earn that 7 cents, right? And of course, notice that in the process of exploiting a profit opportunity that I perceive, what am I doing to those profits as I exploit them? Right? Well, what's happening in the market for factors as I'm buying them up? The prices of those factors are doing what? Going up. Right? As I begin to bring my finished product over here and I sell it over here, what's happening to the price in this market when I'm selling high? I'm driving the price down. Okay, so, you know, as arbitrage opportunities are exploited, whether through time or through space, they tend to be squeezed out. Okay, so they're eliminated in the process of pursuing them. So they don't last forever. They may be fleeting. They may be ephemeral, right? A key difference between Kirzner's formulation of the entrepreneur and the one in Knight and the one that I associate with Mises is there's no role or a very limited role for uncertainty in Kirzner's formulation. Kirzner is interested in profit opportunities that are there, available for the grasping, and all you have to do is reach out and grab them. Okay? And, you know, ex post, a lot of profit opportunities look like that. Right? I mean, think about a bunch of you have iPads. Think about the iPad. Right? You know, what if you had a time machine and you could go back to, when was the first iPad introduced? 2005? 2010 was iPad 1, the first generation, 2010? Okay, Zach could go back to 2008. And if you told people that, you know, you could sell a tablet that you could touch, like a giant iPhone, and people would pay $600, $700, $800 for it, people, they would think you were crazy, right? But it's like, once the iPad is in existence, you kind of go, oh man, why didn't I think of that? I could have done that. I could have made those, I could have bought those materials and assembled it, and I could have sold it the same way that Apple does. It's just, dang it, that clever Steve Jobs thought of it and I didn't. Okay, so in hindsight, you know, profitable activities often appear that way. It's like, well, anybody could have done that if they just realized that you could do it and be successful. But not everybody did realize, only a few people did. That, according to Kirzner, is the difference between the non-entrepreneur and the entrepreneur. However, the problem is from the point of view of Apple in 2008 or 2009, right, or whoever, the guy who's gone back in the time machine, you don't know for certain that consumers will, in fact, buy this thing. I mean, maybe they will, but maybe it will be a total flop. And, you know, I'm interested in talking about Steve Jobs because I've been reading the Walter Isaacson biography of Jobs. But, you know, Jobs is people have forgotten that he had, you know, many spectacular failures as well as spectacular successes. The Lisa, his computer that anticipated the Macintosh. And when Jobs was forced out of Apple, he founded his own computer company called Next. And Next was going to be the next great innovation in computer. And that company, the product flopped. That company went bankrupt. So, you know, when you're just starting out, you may think, oh, yeah, this is going to work. This is going to be so great. If it does work, after the fact, you say, man, what a genius. He perceived that opportunity. Okay, but in practice, you don't know if you're going to be successful or not. So Steve Jobs and his resource providers were bearing a huge amount of uncertainty when the iPad was being researched and developed and so forth. Now, Kirzner says that, look, of course we have uncertainty in the real world, but if all we can say is there's uncertainty and action under uncertainty, we might be wrong, we might be right, then we can't make any statements about markets, you know, coordinating economic activities and prices being the right prices as opposed to the wrong prices. We just have chaos. We can't say anything about markets working well or poorly. So he says it must be the case that entrepreneurs can see through uncertainty. He uses the term piercing the fog. Entrepreneurship must be able to pierce the fog of uncertainty. Otherwise, it's useless. It doesn't do anything for us. Why can he say that? Because for Kirzner, the main phenomenon of interest is not profit and loss, but the consequence of entrepreneurial behavior to market prices. Right? The question that Kirzner wants to answer is, why do prices tend to converge towards equilibrium values? Why is it that, you know, arbitrage opportunities in currency markets are not, there are not tons of them there all the time? Right? Opportunities tend to be exploited. The law, you know, economists call the law of one price, tends to hold. There's a tendency for these prices to equilibrate. And Kirchner says, well, if prices were not in equilibrium, if the same good were selling for two prices in two different markets, then somebody could make a lot of money from arbitraging that. And there aren't a lot of those opportunities around. So somebody must be arbitraging them. Okay, so entrepreneurship is invoked indirectly as a means to explain the tendency toward equilibrium. And as I suggested before, I think when Mises talks about sort of systematic tendencies, when Mises talks about the market process, he doesn't mean the process of equilibration. He means the selection process by which bad entrepreneurs go bankrupt and skilled entrepreneurs are rewarded. Okay, I should also mention Joseph Schumpeter. He's not really a member of the Austrian school, though he was trained in by Böhm Bawerk in Vienna. And Schumpeter was sort of an Austrian person, Austrian national, and extremely influential on the younger Austrians, such as Hayek and others of Hayek's generation. But Schumpeter is really more in the tradition of Walras, sort of neoclassical general equilibrium theory. But Schumpeter characterized the entrepreneurial function not as decision-making under uncertainty, not as alertness, but more as a kind of innovation, right? The introduction of new stuff, new goods, new services, new markets, and so on. People have sometimes characterized Schumpeter's contribution as a sort of Austrian addition to Walrasian general equilibrium, meaning that Schumpeter thought that the Walrasian equilibrium model was the right one to describe the economy. That was the best way to understand how markets and prices work. But of course, the Walrasian general equilibrium model is a static model. Once you're in equilibrium, that model is about describing equilibria. It doesn't give us any theory of economic change. But Schumpeter, being a perceptive guy, of course, recognized that in the real world there is a lot of economic change. And he wanted to reconcile the reality of economic change and progress and development with this static equilibrium model. And the way he did it was to say, well, you know, we can describe the economy as being in equilibrium in the sense of Walras, but then there's an external shock, right? Some dynamic agent introduces an innovation sort of from the skies, from outside the model, and that pushes the economy to a new equilibrium with new products and services or new and better production methods and so forth. So while Kirchner's entrepreneur is an equilibrator, Schumpeter's entrepreneur is a disequilibrator. Schumpeter's entrepreneur shocks the existing equilibrium and allows us to, you know, to allows the economy to progress through time. You know, you may have heard the term creative destruction, which is a famous. Schumpeter was a great rhetorician. And one of the great characters in the history of economic thought. Some of you may get the joke. The reason I have Schumpeter on a horse is because he famously quipped as a young man in Vienna that his ambitions in life were to become the best economist, the best horseman, and the best lover in all of Vienna. But he would say, sadly, he only achieved two out of the three. And you had, I guess you had to guess which two. So, you know, what I have tried to hint to you today or explain to you today, and I've elaborated in more detail in other writings, is that I see Mises' view as very different from Kirchner's and very different from Schumpeter's. I see Mises' view as much closer to the view of Frank Knight, right? And the term that Frank Knight used to describe what the entrepreneur does is judgment. Knight says this: the way entrepreneurs deal with uncertainty is they exercise judgment about the future. And judgment is, you know, sort of perceptions of an uncertain future that cannot be parameterized in an equation, in a formal decision-making model. So you can think of alertness, innovation, and judgment as three alternative ways of conceiving the entrepreneurial function. But all of these theorists that I've mentioned would share the view that entrepreneurship is best understood not as an empirical phenomenon, but as an abstract functional category. Okay, finally, I could just say a word or two about how public policy, how government action, government intervention affects entrepreneurship. And there are a number of different ways that we could approach this problem. One that I think is particularly important and still needs further development within the Austrian tradition, is the way that entrepreneurs act under the conditions of the business cycle. Right? So what happens under credit expansion? And it's very interesting, the terminology that Mises uses in addressing this problem of why, and it's been discussed in several lectures this week. I think Tom Woods mentioned it yesterday, and I think, Lucas, you mentioned it as well. You know, why is it that entrepreneurs are fooled into investing and expanding their business when the interest rate is artificially low, right? If they understand Austrian business cycle theory and they know that the central bank is expanding the money supply and driving the interest rate down, why don't they wait and, you know, simply refuse to participate? And there are many good responses to that question, which have been discussed here this week. Even if you know the theory, you don't know exactly when interest rates will rise. You're competing against other entrepreneurs who are making investments at those lower interest rates, and they'll bid factors away from you and so forth. But the terminology that Mises uses in explaining why businessmen invest at interest rates when interest rates are artificially low, beyond what they would invest if the interest rates were at their, you know, natural, at the natural rate of interest, he says that credit expansion distorts economic calculation. It distorts the calculation of the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur cannot or is impeded from engaging in this activity of comparing anticipated future receipts against present expenditures. Prices are distorted. He speaks about profits being illusory, right? In the boom conditions created by credit expansion, the conditions of the artificial boom, profits appear to be larger than they really are. Right, entrepreneur thinks that he or she is doing very well when, in fact, consumer demands are not consistent with the pattern of activities engaged in by the entrepreneur. Besides credit expansion, right, we can think of government policies that obtain even outside the business cycle. You know, some are obvious, right? Bailouts to failing businesses, subsidies and special protections for particular kinds of activities, right, impede this selection process between skilled and unskilled entrepreneurs, right? I mean, if you're just not very good at economic calculation, if you do not possess good judgment in Knight's terminology, and you systematically earn losses, but you're best friends with somebody in the Treasury who can write you a check, right? Well, okay, then the argument doesn't go through. Then you won't be selected out, right? You might continue to be an entrepreneur for generation after generation, even though you don't have any skill in it, General Motors. banks. So these are some policies that sort of make entrepreneurship more difficult. What about on the other side? You know, is it possible that government policy can help the entrepreneur somehow? And you find that a lot of state and local government agencies have government-funded training programs, teach people how to be entrepreneurs, by which they mean teach people accounting and how to get venture capital and that sort of thing. Actually funding, giving government money to startup businesses, subsidies for research and development expense, prizes for innovators, and so on. I mean, one thing that I think is important to keep in mind in evaluating these programs is that, you know, we talked about what Mises calls the promoter, Mises promoter entrepreneur, the Steve Jobs type, right? We've talked about successful and unsuccessful capitalist entrepreneurs. Well, look, I mean, it by no means is it the case that every single agent in the market economy is best employed in one line of work or another, right? Not everybody is good at being a Steve Jobs. And it isn't the case that all of us necessarily should do that. Right, some of the popular literature on entrepreneurship nowadays makes it sound like, well, gosh, I mean, every student should be encouraged to be an entrepreneur. And if you graduate from college or you graduate from business school and you go to work for IBM, oh, that's so sad. You know, what a failure, right? It's somehow better to start your own company and work for yourself. I mean, well, from the point of view of praxeology, that doesn't follow at all, right? I mean, there's no reason that not everyone is good at the same thing. There's heterogeneity, there's diversity among different skills and attributes and interests and so forth. In other words, you can think of a kind of a natural market pattern, right? Here is the, you know, distribution of individuals to different functional roles that would obtain on the free market. By no means is it the case that having more laborers or less laborers than would otherwise obtain, more capitalist entrepreneurs or entrepreneur promoters than would otherwise obtain on the free market, there's no reason that that's good, right? So some of these programs and subsidies may actually be giving us too many entrepreneurs, too much entrepreneurship in this functional sense, okay? You know, of course, it won't surprise you, I'm sure, to hear that from the point of view that I'm expounding, right, the best policy that the government can engage in to give us the right amount of entrepreneurship is to basically stay out of the way, right? You know, sound money and protection for property rights. I'm not saying that the government should do those things, but the best policy environment, the best environment for the right kind of entrepreneurship in the right amounts and directed to the right activities is a regime of stable money and secure private property rights and, you know, no government interference with the price mechanism, economic liberty more generally. Thank you very much.